place. I mean, some people will say it's just a bridge, and at times I guess I'd certainly agree. But then there are other times. Times like tonight, when it feels like there's more going on here. Times when it seems like there might be something else happening in the universe. Like someone is watching over us. Too much magic, if that's the right word, to have this be a normal place. Does that make sense? Dave was speechless. In the middle of the fog and drizzle, on a wretched night when it didn't seem possible for his life to get any worse, a crazy woman now stepped out of the fog to ramble on about the bridge. Was she on drugs? Delusional? A wayward tour guide? She'd asked him if she made sense, and then she had waited, as if he was supposed to answer. She made no sense. He felt no need to address her. She continued to babble. It was important to my dad because he saved the lives of 28 people here. Because the bridge meant so much to him, I learned to love it as well. I apologize for rambling like this. I was just out on the bridge tonight walking around, thinking about him. Thinking about how important he was to me. Thinking about the lives that he saved. Then I noticed you. And even though you're a stranger and you didn't know my father, I wanted to tell someone. You know, let someone else know what he did for them. And what he did for me. She paused again. Dave didn't speak. He had nothing to say. Instead, he stepped to his bike, grabbed the handlebars, and threw his leg over the wet seat. He pushed a step forward, stopped, and stared at her again. She seemed sincere, friendly. Tonight, however, he was simply too tired and confused to care. He'd been having thoughts. Dark, terrible thoughts. At least she had interrupted those. He wished he could stay, perhaps help this woman, listen to her problems. It was great for her that she was in love with this place, but to him it felt utterly miserable. The cold steel and dismal fog, unrelenting, unforgiving. He was starting to shiver. It was time to leave. Before he could start his bike, she spoke again. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your thoughts. I know you were busy. I just wanted to tell someone about my father, and I happened to see you. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Sorry again for the bother." When she finished, he whispered something to her, though he guessed she wasn't close enough to hear. It didn't matter. He couldn't help her. Certainly not now. Drenched and miserable, he'd decided to finish what he had come here to do. Dave didn't look at her again. Instead, he started up his bike, and in the last handful of minutes remaining on the 4th of July, he finished his ride across the bridge to the south, then returned back the way he'd come from the north. He rode on into the darkness, away from the towers. Away from the cables, away from the lights and the fog, away from hope.
I'm sure my sneeze startled me more than it did him. He was a bit tense at first. Of course, what else could be expected when I just kept rambling on? He must have thought I was the crazy one. As I look back on the experience, I'm surprised that he didn't pick me up and toss me off the bridge just to shut me up. I didn't have a clue what to say, so I just tried to be myself. I told him about my father, about the selfless man that he was. I told him about the bridge. I can't say that I helped him. I'll admit he appeared tired and lost even after I finished. But when he got on his bike and rode away, I'd like to think that he took at least a small glimmer of hope. In thinking back, I guess I should have asked how I could help. I should have asked for his name and given him mine. I should have done more than just talk. I should have listened. Life is often like that. A lot of time spent wishing we'd done things differently. Mostly, I can't help but wonder about the sneeze. If it hadn't happened, I don't think I'd have had the courage to stay. It's just so strange that it would happen when it did. I know that some will think me a foolish and naive girl, but I think that my dad may have been there after all. I used to imagine that when my father talked people down from the bridge, the right words would pop into his head, that he would always have the perfect solution. I'm guessing now that it wasn't that way at all. I'm guessing that, like me, he often felt confused and alone, that he didn't always have answers. I'm guessing that, instead, he just tried to be himself. I'm thinking that perhaps what my father said to the people on the bridge wasn't as important as the fact that he was there to say it. I think he was just trying his best. I remember him telling me from time to time about the people he had saved. His only regret was that, out of the 28, not a single one had ever come back to express any gratitude. And yet, he still kept going out, still kept saving everyone he could. I don't know if the man I met on the bridge would have actually jumped. Perhaps he doesn't even know. It's just that if my father was really there, if he was helping me, then it seems like such a fitting end. You see, after the man in the black leather jacket climbed onto his bike, just before he rode off into the darkness across the bridge, he whispered two words that my father would have appreciated. The man on the bridge looked up at me and said, "Thank you."
Chapter 40. Dave didn't stop, didn't look back. The dark feelings were like a demon, and he wanted to create as much distance as he possibly could. 10 miles past the memories, he approached a dimly lit sign. Golden Tower Motel. Vacancy. It was sleazy, but for tonight it would do. He was too tired and wet to continue. And where was he to go? He was on a journey now with no destination. No end. He steered his bike into the parking lot and stopped near the office. When he pushed open the door, the lobby was empty. The place reeked of rancid smoke and mildew. What looked to be a second-hand shower curtain hung between the front office and a back room. A TV blared behind the curtain. Dave pressed the bell on the counter and waited. Within a few seconds, the curtain parted, and a heavy-set woman, dressed in a nurse's uniform, waddled through the opening. Her makeup was thick, and her voice low, almost the tone of a man. With steely eyes, she surveyed Dave and the trail of water he tracked through the door. Next, she glanced toward his bike, waiting in the rain. "Can I help you?" "I need a room, please." She moved close to the counter, her eyes reading the stranger.
"All I have left is 2 double beds.
"That'll be fine."
"It's $145 plus tax."
The price was ridiculous for the run-down dump. But Dave was too tired to argue. "I'll take it." She pushed a guest sheet fastened to a clipboard in his direction.
"Fill this out."
Her tone was demanding, and under other circumstances he would have turned and walked out the door. Tonight he took the clipboard, scribbled in the information, and pushed it back to her. "Here you go." She scanned the scrawled answers.
"How do you want to pay?"
Dave reached into his back pocket and removed his wallet. It was soaked completely through. The bills were matted and pressed together into one lump. Rather than create a spectacle by separating them now, he pulled out his American Express gold card and dropped it in front of the woman. She snatched it from the counter, her eyes darting from the name on the card to the sheet that Dave had filled out. She then studied the picture of the man on the card. It had been taken 2 years earlier. It showed a smiling man with short hair, clean-shaven face, and an expensive suit. She compared it to the biker standing before her. Dirty, long hair, stubbled beard, and bloodshot eyes. She looked suspicious. He didn't care. She moved to the machine and swiped the card. Her forehead lifted in surprise when the approval flashed onto the screen. She scribbled the number on a pad and then reached under the counter and into a box of keys.
"I don't want any problems," she said,
as she slapped a key onto the counter and slid it over.
"Room 107. Around the corner. You've only paid for a single, so no one else is allowed in the room. No other bikers."
Too exhausted to respond to the mistrusting woman, Dave grabbed the key and headed out the door. He pulled his bike around the corner in the direction that she had pointed and found room 107 on the lower floor. He shoved his key into the lock and then pushed himself inside. When he clicked the light switch, nothing happened. In the darkness, he moved to the outline of a lamp on the desk near the bed and fumbled for the knob. As it turned, the light flickered on. The room was cleaner than he had expected, though the furniture was certainly dated. He slumped onto the nearest bed and pulled off his boots and socks. His feet were red and swollen. He walked barefoot to the bathroom and twisted on the shower before moving back to the bed to peel off the rest of his saturated clothing. Since there were two double beds, he sat down on the one closest to the door, the one where he'd left his wet boots and socks. It didn't matter if the bedspread got soaked through with his wet clothing, he reasoned. He would sleep in the other bed. It would serve them right for overcharging customers. He pulled off his jacket and draped it over the chair near the space heater on the wall. He turned the temperature dial to the hottest setting. The fan kicked on. Next, he stripped off his shirt and undershirt and tossed them beside his boots. A wave of exhaustion was rolling over him. Not just physical, but mental and emotional fatigue as well. He sagged onto the edge of the bed, thoughts of Megan still resonating. He pushed them away. Not now. No more pain today. Steam billowed from the bathroom door. He didn't care. There would be plenty of hot water. It would wait. He started to undo his belt and felt his wallet in his back pocket. He pulled it out from his pants and removed its saturated contents. Too exhausted to consider otherwise, he peeled apart the wet bills and credit cards and laid them across the bedspread to dry. The slamming knock at the door startled him. He didn't move. Again, several loud raps rattled the door. Most motel rooms had a small viewer that allowed the person on the inside to see who was standing on the outside. This one didn't. Dave shot a glance at the security door chain that dangled loosely against the door jamb. It had not been set. He moved to the door and touched the knob. He listened intently, not sure if it was safe to open. The door rattled with knocks again. This time, he heard voices.
"Open up the door now! This is the police!"
Dave twisted the knob and pulled the door open a crack. Outside, a drawn firearm was aimed at his head.
"Down on the ground, now!"
the officer yelled. He obeyed and dropped to the floor.
"What's going on?"
Dave grunted, as his arms were twisted behind him, and a pair of handcuffs tightened into place around his wrists.
"Look, there's been a mistake. You have the wrong guy."
A second officer entered the room, his weapon drawn, to sweep the place for additional suspects. He dashed toward the steaming bathroom and burst inside. The first officer held his gun in place and began to read Dave his rights.
"You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. Should you choose not to..."
"I told you this is a mistake. You have the wrong person," Dave interrupted.
"I just checked in. Ask the lady at the front desk."
The policeman, unfazed by the interruption, continued his monologue.
"Knowing and understanding your rights as I have explained them to you, are you willing to answer questions without an attorney present?"
"Of course, but like I told you..." Dave turned his head to see the office lady standing outside the open motel room door, watching the events unfold. Upon hearing the commotion, Half a dozen other spectators had exited their rooms and were gawking as well. The second policeman returned from the bathroom, his gun now replaced in his holster.
"The place is empty. He's alone, at least for now."
Then he noticed the rows of neatly laid out bills and credit cards spread incriminatingly across the bed. He moved closer and picked a card up, the same one that Dave had shown the motel clerk.
"My, oh my, what do we have here?"
Dave, with his face against the floor and hands cuffed behind his back, remained confused.
"Please," he pleaded. "What's this all about?"
He arched his head to meet the policeman's glance.
"Crack down on fraud and burglary," the man in blue replied. "Seems we've had a bit of a problem with bikers running an identity theft ring, and this neighborhood has been ground zero. So it begs the question, when are your friends arriving?"
"Friends? I'm alone. I promise, I'm not involved." The man studied the photo, and then glanced to Dave on the floor.
"Of course not," he said, his words sopping with sarcasm.
To Dave, it was becoming clear. The nervous glances when he was checking in. The comparison of the pictures.
"Look, those credit cards are mine, I swear."
"Really? Will you pinky swear?"
His tone mocked.
"I promise, I..."
The man cut Dave's sentence in half, didn't give him time to continue. The closer he leaned, the more aggravated he became.
"Look, buddy, I've been on shift for 10 hours now, and I just can't listen to any more of this crap. I don't know where you come from, but stealing credit cards is a crime in California."
He turned to his partner with disgust.
"Nick, load him in the car."
Dave was jerked to his feet and herded out of the door.
"Let me at least get dressed," he pleaded,
still barefoot and with no shirt. While the first officer stuffed Dave into the back seat of the squad car, the second snatched Dave's shirt from the bed, his wet boots from the floor, and the leather jacket from the chair. He rolled them into a bundle, and then tossed them into the back of the waiting squad car. Dave arrived with the officers at the Court Madera police station on Doherty Drive, north of San Francisco. The thought of putting back on the wet shirt was repulsive, but once his handcuffs had been removed so they could fingerprint him, he stretched it back onto his body. He was cuffed again. His mugshots were taken. His statement was noted. His record filed. He tried again to plead his case with the intake sergeant, but found him even less caring than the two officers who had brought him in. After the booking was complete, he was led by two more men down a long, narrow hall and past two security checkpoints. At each one, an armed policeman behind thick plexiglass buzzed them through self-locking steel doors. Once inside, they approached a row of holding cells. All held at least one accused perpetrator. Some, two. A steel-barred door opened with a buzz and a clank at the same time that Dave's handcuffs were released. He was escorted inside, and the door locked behind him.
"How long will I be here?"
he asked, as the escorting officers retreated from the direction they had come.
"You'll be the first to know,"
one guard replied to the other, rather than addressing Dave.
"The first to know."
Bolt laughed at the comment, then vanished behind the locked steel door. The man lying on the cot was big. Dave presumed he was sleeping, but once the officers had disappeared, he rolled over and sat up on the edge of the bed. His eyes were cold and bloodshot, his stare icy. Dave stared back, not sure how to respond or what to say. Only the man's eyes moved, sizing Dave up, like a wild animal, assessing the fight in its prey. Without saying a word, Dave backed to the cot on the opposite side of the cell and sat down. He kept an eye on the man, who was still staring, perhaps still deciding what move to make next. When the man finally spoke, his voice was like steel.
"What are you doing with my jacket?"
Dave wasn't sure that he'd understood.
What? Are you deaf? I want my jacket back.
The man stood. He was about Dave's height, perhaps slightly taller. His shoulders were broad. Dave stood as well.
Look, this jacket was a gift from my wife. It's not yours. You calling me a liar?
The man took a step toward him. Dave held his ground. The man's eyes burned with hatred.
I'm telling you for the last time, give me my jacket now!
It was not just a jacket. It was a gift from Megan, a piece of her, one of the last pieces he held. Vicious threat or not, there was no way he would part with it. Dave took a step forward, now just inches away from the man. He stood tall with his broadened shoulders, hoping to intimidate.
I'm telling you, man, this is my jacket, not yours. And I'm not giving it to you, or anybody for that matter. If you want it, you'll have to take it. But it'll be over my dead body.
He hoped his aggressiveness would cause the guy to back down, even frighten him. Regardless, his words weren't an act. When he said over my dead body, he meant each and every syllable. Whatever it took, he was keeping the jacket.
Dead body? You saying I'll have to kill you first?
The man didn't seem fazed by Dave's boldness. He turned back toward his own cot. As he did, Dave breathed a silent sigh of relief. The man's next move was so quick, it caught Dave completely by surprise. In one motion, the man jolted back, his clenched fist catching Dave in the lower jaw.
Killing you won't be a problem, he said,
as a second fist pelted Dave in the abdomen. The blow was stunned. He gasped for air, not able to breathe in or out. He was dazed, shocked, bent over, but still standing. The man continued to growl, but it was hard to make out the garbled words.
Kill you? If you want me to kill you, I'll kill you!
The next blow caught Dave in the face as he fought for air. He dropped to the concrete floor in a crumpled ball beside his cot, as everything in the room faded to black. Chapter 41. The sun was shining as he rode over the crest of the hill, the ocean waves coming into full view. The rays warmed his face, a refreshing change from the terrible rainstorms that he'd just ridden through. He slowed his bike to bask in the warmth and to admire the surroundings. The low rumble of the engine beneath him was sweet and solid. The valley around him was green and lush with plants, strange plants, blanketing each side of the highway. He could see the bridge in the distance, and it was stunning, just like he'd remembered as a child. The pillars towered, huge orange skyscrapers reaching heavenward, roped together with strands of massive twisted cable. The road should have been crowded with people coming to enjoy the splendor of such a day, the majesty of such a bridge. And yet today, the path lay vacant and deserted. The sky above the bridge was an astonishing shade of vivid blue, with only a few wispy clouds on the horizon that served to contrast the deepness of its color. As the bike rolled on toward the grandeur before him, Dave could feel and smell the ocean air blowing in from the bay. It was fresh and cool, the perfect mixture of salt and sea. His hair blew in the wind. It was just as he had imagined it. The bridge to freedom, lay majestically before him, beckoning. The view was grand, and he found himself wishing Megan were with him to share in the moment. No sooner had the thought entered his mind than the sound of another bike startled him. As he turned to look behind him, Megan pulled up to his side. It was peculiar to see her riding a motorcycle, so out of character. And yet she looked comfortable on the bike, at peace, and enjoying the beauty of the day. It had been so long since they'd been together, so many months since they'd had a chance to talk. He wanted to speak, to touch her, to hold her, to tell her how much she had been missed. He knew the rumble of the engines would drown out his words, but he found himself speaking them anyway. "Meg, I've missed you." He was startled to hear her answer, whispered, and yet as clear as if they'd stood in a quiet room alone. "I've missed you as well, honey." Her voice was sweet and soft, her smile radiant, her face and body so full of life. "It's been so hard without you," he said, not knowing if she had known the turmoil in his life. She smiled her understanding, a smile that let him know that she was aware, that she cared. "You've been doing fine, Ponytail Man, just fine." He'd never felt fine, not until today. His thoughts turned to the children. "What about Brad, Brittany, Angel? How are they?" No sooner had he spoken their names than the sound of another bike resonated behind them. He turned to see Brad pull up adjacent to Meg. He was riding his own bike, a dark blue classic Swifttail with shimmering chrome, a smaller, easier-to-handle bike. Dave recognized the model from the showroom at Lakeshore. Brittany sat in back, her arms wrapped tightly around Brad's waist. Brad gave Dave a thumbs-up sign before he spoke.
"This is the coolest, Dad! Absolutely the coolest!"
Brittany's braces glistened as she beamed her approval of the journey as well. With a slight acceleration of the throttle, Brad's bike pulled ahead, taking the lead in their excursion toward the bridge. "And Angel?" Dave asked Megan once Brad had passed. As he spoke her name, Dave noticed a sidecar attached to Meg's bike. Strange that he hadn't seen it before. Angel was seated in the sidecar, surrounded by a few of her favorite toys. She held a flower in her hand from which she was pulling the petals and leaves and letting them go in the wind. Watching them flutter away made her giggle.
"Still precocious?" Dave questioned.
"Afraid so," Megan responded with a laugh. A laugh that was rich, warm, and familiar. The bridge was drawing closer, the pillars rising high into the sky as they neared its entrance. The purring sound of the engine on Dave's bike changed. A quick sputter, a sudden loss of power. He twisted the accelerator, hoping it would help. The engine continued to falter. It was the carburetor, the same problem he'd had outside of Liberty. He reached down and tapped the side of the bike. The sputtering worsened.
"Meg!"
His heart quickened at the realization that he might not be able to keep up. She slowed her speed to match his, aware of his trouble and concern.
"Meg, it's the carburetor," he continued, pointing down at the engine. "It gave me some trouble a ways back, near Liberty. It needs an adjustment. I need to stop and fix it, but I can't be left behind."
Her tone was understanding, her voice full of reassurance.
"Honey, it's okay. I think that you should stay here and get your bike fixed. Do what you need to. Get things taken care of. Then catch up to us later.
I'll ride up ahead with the kids. We'll wait for you on the other side of the bridge." He wanted to protest, to change her mind, to convince her and the children to stay. She continued,
"Everything will be fine. We'll be waiting for you. I promise."
The sputtering worsened. Meg's bike pulled slightly ahead.
"I love you," he called to her.
"And I love you too, Ponytail Man."
A warm fog enveloped the bridge. It rolled soundlessly across the structure, its piers and anchorages, its cables and towers. As Dave's bike coasted to a stop on the side of the road, he watched Brad and Brittany enter the bridge first. He could hear their laughter, feel their anticipation. Next, he watched Megan and Angel approach the structure. He wanted to feel sad. Sad that they were leaving. Sad that he was being left behind. But for the first time in months, he didn't. She was distant now, but he thought he heard her voice one last time. "I love you, Ponytail Man." He watched Meg glide onto the bridge of magic, the bridge of hope, and then slowly disappear into the mist with Angel by her side, still throwing petals into the wind. Chapter 42. Dried blood caked his face, and his head pounded. He tried to open his eyes, but they were covered with dirt and blood. He pushed himself up into a sitting position. He'd been passed out on the concrete floor. His muscles were stiff and sore. He focused first on the filthy sink in the corner, and then on the cot on the opposite side of the cell. Dave wished he could rinse the blood from his face, but he feared that he might disturb his cellmate, who was asleep and wearing the tight-fitting leather jacket. The buzz of the steel door sounded, and the man on the cot stirred. Dave could hear voices, but none that he recognized.
"Get him out! Get him out now! The boys upstairs have done it again!"
The cell door rattled open, and three uniformed guards stepped inside. The tallest of the three appeared to be in charge. He directed the others, who moved to Dave's side to help him up. Dave's joints ached as he attempted to stand. He spoke softly.
"I swear it's me in the picture."
The guard in charge turned toward the other two.
"Oh, they're well aware of that now. Down here, we're just wondering why the hell the city's finest couldn't figure it out last night."
Dave's cellmate, who'd been watching from his cot, now sat up. The guard motioned Dave toward the door.
"So I'm free to go?" Dave asked.
"Of course. That's a nasty cut in your eye. Did that happen last night?"
Without a word, Dave glanced at his cellmate. The man on the cot shrugged, spat on the floor, then leaned back against the wall. The two men at Dave's side reached out to help him walk. He shrugged off their assistance and stepped ahead alone. He paused at the door and then turned to address the tallest of the guards.
"Are you in charge here?"
"Down here I am. Paul McGuire."
He held out his hand. Dave reached out and shook it.
"Mr. McGuire, can I ask a favor of these men?"
"I guess that depends on what you have in mind."
Dave leaned over and whispered to the circle of men. Paul McGuire was the first to speak.
"I think that's doable."
He turned toward the two guards and nodded his approval.
"Gentlemen,"
he directed. Dave stepped back into the cell with the uniformed men and toward the burly man sitting on the cot. As they approached, he stood.
"I'd like my jacket back," Dave said politely.
The man grunted a response. Dave took it as a no. With as hard a punch as Dave could muster, he drove his fist into the man's stomach. Instantly, the man buckled over, though he remained on his feet. He lunged toward Dave, but the two guards had already stepped forward. Each grabbing an arm, they stripped the jacket from him, pushed him back down onto the cot, and then handed the jacket to Dave.
"Thank you," he said to the still gasping men. "I knew you'd understand."
Then, accompanied by the three uniformed men, he turned and walked through the cell door, a free man. The sky was still cloudy as Dave retraced his path across the bridge. But this time, he could see patches of blue dotting the horizon. He slowed down when he reached the structure's midpoint. The pillars, the cables, the towers. Everything looked different today. Everything felt different. He didn't stay long. He didn't need to. A few miles down the road, he pulled off to eat. After he'd finished, he called Red. Red, it's Dave. How are you?
Dave, good to hear from you. I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
I'm okay.
How's the bike working?
Just the one little detour. Otherwise, she's been great.
Glad to hear it. Listen, you may not want to hear this right now, but I've had a bunch of visitors around here this last week.
Visitors?
Well, yeah. First, your friend Brock and his boss came by. Then, the next thing I know, the CEO of Bike House himself shows up, asking for me. You should have seen my boss's face. I think my job security is at an all-time high.
So, what's up?
Well, they came asking for me, but only 'cause they need to find you.
Me?
Yes, sir. Seems you stood up in the middle of an important meeting, said to hell with it all, and walked out, just so you could take off on your new motorcycle.
I guess I did. And they're still mad?
Mad? They want to make you the Bike House poster child. CEO wants to meet you. Their ad people have been going crazy. They're thinking of recreating the whole thing for their TV commercials. A highly paid executive who chucks it all to ride off on his bike to find life's answers. You have to admit, it has possibilities.
You're serious?
Oh, they're convinced this approach will sell more motorcycles than Easy Rider. Problem is, they'd like your permission. Oh, you've got a slew of people looking for you, all right.
Dave was stunned. He could only imagine the look on Ellen's face. Red continued.
And here's the best part. I'm chatting with the CEO, and he starts asking me questions. He wants to know what I think. Can you imagine? The CEO asking what I think.
Congratulations, Red.
Thanks. So?
Red hesitated, as if not sure how to ask.
What should I tell them?
Nothing yet. If you'll wait to tell them that I called, I'd appreciate it.
No problem. And Dave, how did it go?
On the long stretches of road, Red, I still think about her and the children. I still remember her smile, her voice, the highlights in her hair from too much time in the sun, the way she'd touch my hand. But it's different now. It's better.
It's so good to hear you say that. What are your plans? Are you heading back this direction?
You'll be the first to know, Red. The very first to know.
It's been 9 days since I met the stranger on the bridge. Since then, I've hardly slept. I've scarcely quit typing. My assignment for the society is all but complete. Who knows? The professor may be proud of me yet. I tore up the work that I'd started and began fresh with a clean sheet of paper. I've started fresh in many ways. I realize that there's a more important story to tell than to recite a history of the bridge. I wrote it for the society instead. It's a story that's been held captive inside, trying to find a means to come out. And it found a way. Once it started, I couldn't get it to stop. Ideas and phrases and words poured into my mind so rapidly, I was terrified they would slink away before I had time to get them all down on paper. The story I've created for the society is one of a man who kept a journal about a bridge. It tells of a cable and a selfless iron worker and the lessons they taught to a young girl. It's a story about pain and fear turning into courage and about not giving up on life. It's a story about giving of ourselves to save others. I've pasted a picture on the cover of my assignment. It's a picture of the bridge. My picture. The one I painted long ago. It's a house with a chimney and a white picket fence. There are cows and pigs and a pasture blended with bushes and trees and small yellow flowers covering the yard. Next to the house and connected to it are the tall golden and orange spires of a bridge that springs forth from the ground. I used to think it was odd that there was no ocean in this picture. Odd that, rather than spanning a treacherous strait, the bridge connects to a house and a family. I realize now that the picture is profound, that only as a child was the truth so plainly evident. I'm grateful that it recently came flooding back, that it has again touched my life. You see, I'm beginning to remember, to realize that it's not the cable or the steel or the concrete. It's not the design or the engineering. It's not the structure itself, or even the turbulent ocean that it spans. What matters is that it connects people and families, that lives come together because of it, that they touch each other, become stronger. That's the real magic. I've changed the title of the report. I didn't ask for permission. A Forever Bridge by Patrick O'Reilly and Cade Connolly, as told by Katie Connolly. It's a story that everyone needs to hear. The best news is that I finally spoke to Mr. Riley. He called me at home yesterday. He got my number from his secretary. As I hoped, he is the correct David Riley. He confirmed that his grandfather, Patrick Riley, or Patrick O'Reilly if you prefer, did work on the bridge as a younger man. Mr. Riley was more reserved than I would have guessed from his picture on the internet, but he seemed thrilled, even overwhelmed at the news. I have Patrick's journal, letter, and Anna's ring all packaged up and ready to send to him. Giving up the journal, and especially the ring, will be difficult. They mean such a great deal to me. But they're not mine. And I sense, at least I hope, that they will mean as much to Dave Riley. It's okay that I won't have the journal in my hands to hold. I've instead placed its lessons in my heart. My father taught me that people are like strands of cable, and he's right. But I also think that love is sometimes like that piece of cable as well. If it's not held tightly, if it's dropped, it can break apart into a tangled pile on the floor. I'd been expecting someone else to show up and put the pieces of my cable back together. Perhaps I should have started on my own. The main thing I think I'll remember is that once my cable is together, once it's strong, I'm going to keep the ends tightly wrapped.
Chapter 43. He stopped at a small-town barber shop in Kearney. It had a striped pole out front and an old-fashioned leather and chrome chair inside. It was quaint. Megan would have loved the place. The barber was friendly, even nosy. No doubt a small-town job requirement.
"That's a nasty scar above your left eye, young man. Still a bit red."
"It looks great now," Dave replied. "You should have seen it a couple of months ago."
"Well, I won't ask what happened."
The man's curiosity was evident. "My old barber slipped with his scissors," Dave replied. "That's why I came here." He laughed. It felt good to joke. The barber laughed as well, accepting the teasing answer without pushing further.
"So, how do you want your hair cut?"
Dave considered the question. "I used to keep it short, but I've been wearing it longer lately. I like the look. Just trim it up a little. Take off a couple of inches or so, and it'll be fine." The barber nodded his understanding and began to comb and snip. He chatted politely as he worked.
"You're obviously not from around here."
"No, I'm from Jamesburg. It's on the East Coast."
"You're a long way from home. Are you coming or going?"
"Coming, I guess. I've got a business meeting in L.A. I'll get there eventually."
"Eventually?"
"Yeah, I have a stop to make in Liberty, Colorado. Have you been there?"
"Liberty? Of course. It's, what, 4 or 5 hours west?" "Yes, I've been to Liberty many times. It's a nice little town."
"I agree."
"Yeah, Liberty," the barber repeated. "I had a great aunt who lived there once." "So you have relatives there?"
Nosy again. His job, his nature. Dave didn't immediately reply. It was a stop that he'd been weighing for weeks now, prodded by a note in his Grandpa Patrick's journal. We can't know till we traveled the road. The old barber stopped snipping and waited for Dave to answer. I'm going to Liberty because of some kids. The old man raised an eyebrow.
Kids?
Yes, sir. I need to teach some kids how to play baseball. The park was empty when Dave approached. He'd expected to see two boys hitting balls, with an inquisitive blonde girl umpiring from the bleachers. Instead, the place was deserted. He parked his bike near the stands and climbed up to the second row to sit. The wood was still weathered. The fountain still spewed gallons of fresh water. The late autumn air was still dry. The place still felt inviting. It was a quaint town, and again, Megan would have loved it. He thought of her often, remembered her voice, her smile, the sparkle in her eyes. But the memory was no longer painful, not since his final visit to the bridge. Her voice now seemed to reassure, to coax him forward. He felt a little uneasy about coming back, not sure what the reception might be like, considering his coldness when he had ridden away so many weeks prior. But mixed with his anxiety, indeed woven into the same fabric, were whisperings of hopefulness, longing, and desire, all edging him forward.
Hey, you cut your hair!
Gracie had snuck up on him again, approaching while his mind wandered elsewhere. Her white blonde hair wisped in the breeze as she climbed the steps and stood beside him.
Just a little bit. And I shaved. Do you like it?
She studied him for a long moment before nodding her satisfaction.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, that's good. You want to sit down? The little girl sat beside him.
Jared and Glenn got a new bat,
she announced, as if the news may have made the town paper. They did? Did your mommy buy it for them?
Yep, she had to go to Greeley.
Can they hit better with it?
Guess so,
she shrugged. I figured they'd be out here playing.
Nope, they're doing chores.
You're done already?
Yep.
She chatted as if they'd been friends for life, as if he had never left without saying goodbye. So is your mommy home? He asked.
Yep,
her standard answer. Though in her own observant way, she added,
She's going to be surprised to see you. She was sad when you left.
She was?
Yep.
While they talked, Dave glanced across the field to see two boys approaching with a bat and glove. They were walking slowly, but when they noticed Gracie sitting next to Dave on the bleachers, they began to holler and run. Not far behind them, Dave noticed someone else. Her blonde hair, like Gracie's, reflecting the autumn sun. She walked slowly at first, as if she didn't believe what the boys were hollering back at her, what her eyes were soon telling her. Dave sat up on the battered wood. He couldn't help but watch her approach, admire her confidence. He stepped down from the bleachers and waited as she neared. Crystal approached haltingly and spoke in a dry, sarcastic tone.
I told the kids to leave the bikers alone, and damned if they just won't listen.
He shrugged. Kids will be kids. So, are you just passing through again? On your way to somewhere? I guess that depends. Is there a bike shop in town? Her finger touched her chin.
The mechanic at Darren's just moved to Raleigh. His brother opened up a shop there.
There's always Darren, the owner, but he mostly works on RVs.
That's too bad. I guess I'll have to stay a while then.
He thought he noticed a smile, though it was slight and quickly vanished.
That could be a problem, she said.
It could?
Sure.
The Sundowner's been condemned. And the new motel isn't open yet. Is there a campground?
Not that I know about. Hmm. She put her finger to her lips, pretending to weigh a decision. I do have a spot in my front yard, but it will cost you.
I'll take it.
Okay, then.
She reached out and took his hand. As she did, she turned serious.
Honestly, Dave, I'm surprised to see you.
This time, he held her hand tight and didn't let go. The truth is, after I left here, I couldn't quit thinking about you. She was startled by his blunt response.
You couldn't?
No, not at all. I mean, your batting stance was terrible. You really need some practice.
I see. And you're here to help me.
Absolutely. It's what I do. She pulled away, reached out and took the bat from Jared, and held it out upside down by the fat end.
Like this?
The boys' grins nearly touched their ears. Even Gracie showed a smile. Dave stepped beside her, took the bat, and turned it around. He touched her hands, held them for a moment before placing her fingers around the bat in the proper grip. He then stepped behind her, reaching around her body to hold the bat with her. She relaxed, let him hold her, and it felt familiar, more acceptable, more certain.
Are you ready?
He asked, as he helped bring the bat back into position.
That depends, she said. Are you ready?
He considered the question. This time I am. He swung the bat with her, together. Did you feel that? Did you feel the difference?
Yes, she answered. It does feel different.
Dave drew the bat back once more, as he asked, Are you ready to try it again, then? Crystal pulled away. She turned her face to look him in the eyes.
We are talking about the same thing, aren't we?
She questioned.
I mean, I just need to be sure that I understand what you're asking.
I'm talking about a second chance, Crystal. Another shot.
Are you positive?
I am. Hers was a smile that she couldn't hide. He asked again. Do I get a second chance?
Yes, okay, she answered.
You absolutely get a second chance. Dave turned to Glenn, Jared, and Gracie. Did you hear that? I really hate to lose, so your mom says I get a second chance. The teams are me and Gracie against you three. Now, if everybody's ready, let's play some ball.
I've come to the bridge one last time. My car is overloaded with all my things. I rented a trailer hitch, the kind that bolts onto the bumper, and pulling the tiny U-Haul trailer is about all this little car can handle. There was only room for my father's desk and a box or two of my things. I'll come back in a few weeks to sell the rest of the furniture. The real estate agent said she expects the house to move quickly. I'm not sure what it says about me, being able to pack everything I own into my trunk and a small trailer, but I think I'm finally on the road to figuring it out. In 2 weeks, I begin teaching history to high school students, 11th graders to be exact. The principal called and offered me the job without even requesting an interview. He said we'd already met, the evening he listened to me speak to the crowd at the society banquet, the night I broke down and cried like a baby. He called Professor Winston, who sent up my file along with a hearty recommendation. I wish he would have asked me first, though I certainly won't complain. I never do. It turns out that the principal is from the high school in Crescent City, where the society will debut my material about the bridge. It seems like a great place to begin. I must say the thought of standing in front of a class of high school students scares me crazy, even worse than standing before the gray-haired society ladies. Kids tend to be brutally honest. Then again, it's a trait that I think I'll appreciate. The society is ecstatic with my final report. my lessons from the bridge. And while I'm glad they like it, mostly I'm ready to share it with others. I'm frightened, sure, but at the same time, I feel an energy that I've never known. It's like I finally have something to give, something to pass along, lessons that deserve to be treasured. I said goodbye to the professor. He claimed that he was glad to finally be rid of me, but he did get teary-eyed when we shared a last hug. As usual, he got in the final word. He shouted to me from the window as I climbed into my car. "I thought you should know, Katie," he yelled. "The principal who hired you up in Crescent City, he really likes you. And he's single." I'll miss the professor. I spoke to Dave Riley again last week. He thanked me for sending the journal, said it meant a great deal to him. He asked for my address so he could send a thank you gift. I assured him that there was no need, that coming to know Patrick and Anna was certainly payment enough. He insisted, and I received the box from him yesterday. It wasn't Anna's ring, he certainly cherishes that, but it was strikingly similar. He ordered it from the village of Clada in Ireland. Isn't the internet amazing? Along with the ring came a paper reciting the legend and the words I've grown to love. With this crown, I give my loyalty. With these hands, I promise to serve. With this heart, I give you mine. I wear my ring proudly on my right hand with the crown facing out. My heart is indeed free. The ring, the words, the lives of those before, they all reassure. Yes, I was betrayed, but not all men are betrayers. Yes, I was hurt, but not all relationships cause pain. If I ever forget these truths, I'll take a walk and have another conversation with my father. Mr. Riley gave me his new address in Colorado. He said he was no longer working or living in New York. I look forward to meeting him someday, but there's not time for me to drive all the way to Colorado. Not with a loaded-down car pulling a trailer. Not with 11th graders waiting. But perhaps someday. I leave the bridge in peace. We part as friends. I take so much of her with me, and leave so much of myself behind. I think that's what life must be about. Helping others. Leaving pieces of us with them. In return, fitting borrowed pieces from them into our own voids. Each person helping others along the way. Yes, I'll finally be leaving this crazy old bridge. But I leave with hope in my heart. I'll try not to miss the place too badly. She is, after all, just a bridge.
Epilogue. Memorandum. From Sean R. Safford, Vice President, Marketing. Bike House Customized Motorcycles. To Dave Riley, Vice President, Market Research, Bike House Customized Motorcycles. Dear Dave, I've just been handed the latest sales figures generated from the ad campaign that features you and your bike. The numbers look very good. If sales continue at this pace, then we can all look forward to the best year in the company's history. Congratulations. Also, I want to tell you again that it's been great having you on board as part of my team these last 5 months. I was concerned at first with you living in Colorado, so far away from company headquarters. When you told me you would ride your Harley over once a quarter for the company meetings, I was skeptical. Then I realized that attitude sums up the whole message of the campaign. The whole genius behind it. With email, phones, and video conferencing, one can live just about anywhere these days. I want you to know that it's working out well, and it's been a pleasure having you on board. I look forward to seeing you again in April. Sincerely, Sean. P.S. Congratulations on your engagement. Please give my best to Crystal.
This concludes this